You may proceed.
Good morning. My name is Andrew Lucchetti. May it please the court, I represent the appellant, Mr. Samuel Donovan, and asking this court to overturn the trial court's decision in granting the defendant's plea and bar and statute of limitations. We've asserted two assignments of error. I don't believe that this court needs to go beyond the first assignment and finding that the trial court applied the wrong standard by ruling that the plaintiff failed to meet its burden by presenting a contract, failing to present a contract to the court. Your Honor, no evidence was taken at the trial court level, and so longstanding Virginia law states that when a plea and bar is asserted and no evidence is taken, that the court's review is limited to the pleadings.
Well, will you agree that the pleadings in this case included the deposition?
I do not agree with that, Your Honor. Now, while the Virginia rules don't explicitly enumerate what a pleading is, unlike the federal rules, if you look at 1:4 that the defendant, that appellee cited in his brief in opposition, if you look at section L in that rule, it states pleading, motion, or other paper. So in that rule itself, it's distinguishing pleading from motions and other papers.
But then if the, in opposition to the plea and bar, wasn't the deposition submitted as part of the opposition and the judge said he considered it?
Well, he did, Your Honor, but I don't believe that it was proper.
Did you file an objection with the court about it considering the deposition? If you thought it was improper, it's just like objecting to evidence.
Well, I did. I stated that the ruling should be on the pleadings and not on the facts because no evidence was ever taken. And if the court wanted to rule on evidence, then he should allow us to present evidence of our own.
But I thought there was a continuance to allow for the deposition of the attorney involved and his office staff. And so the judge said, go take some evidence. And that was submitted. The deposition was submitted as an attachment to the opposition. And
to the memorandum in opposition. You're absolutely right, Your Honor. But the reason why we took depositions is because the defendant had every right to move for an ore tenus hearing. And so as plaintiff's counsel, we were trying to ensure that we knew what evidence would be presented.
But that doesn't explain presenting the deposition to the court yourself.
As what the if evidence was presented, what it would show. So well, not as evidence, Your Honor, but as what the evidence would show.
Well, let me ask you then two questions based upon that. No assignment of error, as I read your brief, asserts that the trial court erred in considering the deposition as evidence before it.
I don't believe that's right, Your Honor. I believe our first assignment of error that deals with the fact that he ruled on the basis that he had no contract in front of it. In that assignment, that covers the fact that he ruled outside of the pleadings. Because no contract in front of it, he's applying the improper standard. That's what we said. He's applying the improper standard. And that's, by considering the depositions, is applying the improper standard.
All right. That leads me to the second question. This first assignment of error characterizes the trial court's ruling, and the characterization is, I lost because the trial court said I didn't produce a document. But if we were to read the trial court's full ruling and conclude that's not exactly what the trial court was thinking or doing, or it's not really the ruling of the court, wouldn't that end the analysis of the first assignment of error?
Perhaps, Your Honor, but that's not what the ruling said. He explicitly stated, and I quote, and I believe that plea and bar should be sustained because there is no written agreement that we have before us, period. And the defendant in this case indicates that he didn't have one, and the plaintiff does not have one, period. And so I think if you read the statute you have, if it's the 3-year statute of limitations applies based on the facts as I see them. And for that reason, I'm sustaining the motion.
Did the trial court mention anything about the party to be charged signing whatever document was alleged to exist?
No, Your Honor, it did not. And it explicitly did not make a ruling on that issue. Prior to 1977, when a statute of limitations...
Let me stop you there,
yes,
if I
yes,
could,
Your Honor.
Because the court, you know, court of record speaks through its written orders. And in this case, the judge's written order said, for the reasons stated in open court. So you go to the transcript, and he's in open court. The judge is agreeing that the attorney on page 91 of the joint appendix, that the attorney never executed the agreement. So he's considering that.
He's considering the facts that are outside of the pleadings, Your Honor, and that's improper. That's what our position is. That it's long settled Virginia law that when a plea and bar is ruled upon without evidence, that the trial court must limit its review to the pleadings. And if a memorandum in opposition is not a pleading. And if you also look at three
I don't see you objecting in this transcript. The judge says on page 90, I'm reading his deposition. Do you recall what line? And you say, yeah, I believe he cited for page 21. You're not saying, hey, Judge, don't read that deposition. That's not evidence.
Your Honor, on page 92 of the joint appendix, after the ruling, admittedly, I state no evidence has been taken forth in this matter, Your Honor, and this is on the pleadings itself. And for that reason, I would like to move for an ore tennis to submit evidence to the court for the existence of the contract. And so, while I didn't object to him considering the deposition in oral court, if you look at my opposition, the purpose of attaching the deposition and is stated right there on page 25 of the joint appendix. Defendant cannot show by a preponderance of the evidence that a written contract did not exist. That was the purpose of submitting the deposition and submitting the admission on the in Exhibit B that a written contract did indeed exist.
So you want the judge to consider the deposition for purposes that you offer it, but you don't want him to consider it for purposes that the testimony was, I never signed it?
Well, he never considered the signature requirement, Your Honor. But I wanted to show that there would be no need for an ore tenus hearing if the defendant just should move for one, which he never did. That was the purpose of that. And the law is clear that he cannot consider this deposition if it's the ruling is on the pleadings alone.
So however, you're saying the judge should not have considered the deposition and should just have ruled on your motion?
My complaint, yes, ma'am. Yes, Your Honor.
Does your complaint allege a written agreement?
It doesn't allege a written agreement, Your Honor, but the burden is not on the plaintiff to allege a written agreement in the contract. And that's specifically in Virginia Code 8.01-235. It states, which was enacted in 1977, that statute of limitations defense cannot be set upon by demur. And prior to that code section being enacted, when the statute of limitations affected a right rather than a remedy, the burden was on the plaintiff to allege in their complaint that they were bringing the cause of action within the statute of limitations. That code section, 8.01-235, disbanded that practice. And so after 1977, plaintiff no longer has the burden to plead that they're bringing this contract within the statute of limitations. And so our position is that if the appellee or the defendant wished to prove that the statute of limitations had expired, it was their burden to show that by evidence, since we had not pled ourselves out by the pleadings. And furthermore, we also, as the plaintiff, the facts alleged, not only the facts alleged, but facts implied to the alleged and facts that could be fairly inferred from the complaint. And in our opposition, we cited the Rule of Professional Responsibility 1:5, whereas a contingency fee matter shall be set forth in writing. And so we cited that rule to alert the judge that, you know, we should get the inference based on our pleading, since it is silent, that a written contract did indeed exist, a writing existed. And that's why we cited Dixon v. Hassell for that proposition. But even if the complaint is silent, the defendant can still not meet its burden. There's an old case, Your Honor, and that's Gibbons, Goodell v. Gibbons, and where there was a dispute about a lumber delivery, and now granted this was at trial and there was evidence presented, but in there the proof was silent as to the exact date of delivery of the lumber. The jury found a verdict for the defendant, an error for the whole amount of her demand, and the plaintiffs in error moved for new trial upon the ground there was no proof that the cause of action arose within the statute of limitations.
Counsel, may I interrupt you again?
Yes, sir.
I apologize, but I need to circle back to an earlier question I'm still confused about. The first assignment of error says the trial court erred when it ruled the statute applied to the claim, dot, 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 because there was no written agreement it had before it. As, and the argument continues, Mr. Donovan is not required to produce the document itself. Why wouldn't the right answer for us to your first assignment of error be, well, that's not actually what the trial court ruled. The trial court ruled, it said that, but it also said there was no party to be charged signature, and that alone under subsection 2 is a reason for not applying the 5-year statute.
Because you couldn't have made that determination based upon the pleadings, Your Honor.
But I see that as a different objection, a different issue. Whatever his source of evidence was or wasn't, if his ruling was, well, look, I don't have a written contract in front of me, no one's brought me one, and there's no evidence in any event that it was signed by the party to be charged, which is required by the 5-year statute.
No evidence was taken forth, Your Honor. So it was required, the trial court's determination is limited to the pleadings. So how can we present evidence that a signature existed or make argument on that? And in fact, that was never before the court, whether there was a...
Let me ask you a question. So why was your assignment of error that the court ruled based upon something that wasn't in evidence? Why wasn't that your assignment of error? I mean, because that seems to me to be what you're saying the court did wrong, was consider things that it should not have considered.
Or perhaps granted this over your objection that you wanted a hearing with evidence, opportunity to present evidence.
I believe Simon, error number one covers that, because that was the basis of his ruling. The basis of his ruling was there was no written contract in front of him. And he presented no evidence that there was a written contract.
Let me ask you, it's sort of a big picture question. Had you gotten your hearing, what evidence would be different? You take the deposition of the lawyer who says, I've been through my files, we've changed offices, I can't find any engagement agreement with this client. I probably wouldn't have had one, but in any event, I never, ever, ever signed engagement letters. So it looks like you're never going to be able to come up with a written agreement signed by the attorney, the person against whom is to be charged.
That was the defendant's burden, Your Honor, not plaintiff's. Mm-hmm. And that's where the error lies.
I guess my question is, if we agree with what you said, that you're entitled to hearing, and we send it back for hearing, perhaps it's harmless error because you had all of the information that you were going to have had you been granted a hearing.
I don't believe that I should have been granted a hearing, Your Honor. I believe that the trial court should have overruled the defendant's plea and bar based upon the pleadings. And it's their choice not to present evidence to the court, their choice not to prove that there was no signature, there was no contract. And based on our pleading, the complaint, that's what the trial court was limited to look at, it just couldn't be done.
How do they prove that something doesn't exist?
They present evidence, Your Honor.
That it doesn't exist?
Sure. That he never created this document, that his testimony that I never created this document, and that's why I cited his testimony, because he admits in his deposition testimony that he told Mr. Donovan that he doesn't remember whether a contract existed or not. He states that in his deposition testimony explicitly.
But then he searched his files. He can't find one.
He also admitted that he threw out documents from his file. And then he signs this, he writes on this blank sheet of paper and circles written language and says, this written language may or may not have been in your agreement. Why would he circle written language and say, this may or may not have been in your oral agreement? That doesn't make any sense. So our position was, when we said that to the trial court, that was an admission that the contract existed, and that's what, not that that was the contract in question, that was evidence. That would be our evidence.
Well, how are you going to get around that he says, given that your client didn't keep a copy of anything, and the lawyer says, one thing I do remember is I never signed these agreements.
Well, that's where the incorporation of reference of signatures in the pleadings. He signed pleading after pleading after pleading. He signed petition to this court as counsel for Mr. Donovan, and we believe that that references the retainer agreement, and that would be sufficient to satisfy the signature requirement. I'll reserve my 1 minute for rebuttal.
No, you are 1 minute and 20 seconds beyond your time.
Oh, I see. I apologize. Then I will reserve no time. Thank you, Your Honor.
That's a good try.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Matthew Lee, and I represent the appellee, George Bagwell. Mr. Bagwell is a member of the bar of this court and is in private practice in Halifax County. Your Honors, the dispositive issue in this case is whether or not there were sufficient facts for the circuit court to conclude that the three-year limitation period set forth in Virginia Code 8.01.246.4 applied. Respectfully, Mr. Bagwell contends that there were ample facts for the court to so conclude and that the five-year limitation period under the same statute was not applicable. And we contend that Mr. Donovan has done nothing in this appeal to prove that the circuit court was plainly wrong in so concluding.
Mr. Lee, may I ask you this? I don't know if these briefs have teed the issue up, but it's related. The statute says you get the 5 years under subsection 2 for a written agreement against the party to be charged, right? Signed by the party to be charged.
Yes, sir.
And then you go down to 4 and you got 3 years for an unwritten agreement.
Yes, sir.
What about a written agreement signed by the party doing the charging, not signed by the party to be charged, which is fully acquiesced and assented to by the party to be charged, and thus for purposes of contract formation law is clearly an enforceable agreement? What statute of limitations applies to that?
Where the contract shows on its face a full, complete agreement.
Right, a contract, unlike Dixon, where there is no express condition that there be bilateral signatures. Happens all the time in commercial law. So you have a written contract signed by one party. The other party unequivocally assents to the written contract, so it's not an oral contract. What statute of limitations applies when the party doing the charging, who signed the written agreement, is suing the party to be charged who verbally, orally, or otherwise fully assented to the written agreement and thus is bound by it? What statute of limitations applies?
Paragraph 4 would apply, Your Honor, in the three-year limitations period, because paragraph 2 has the express requirement that the person to be charged have signed the agreement.
Well, follow that through for a second. As you point out, paragraph 2 clearly would not apply because the party to be charged has not signed it. But that doesn't make it an unwritten agreement. It's still a written agreement.
I don't disagree with that at all, Your Honor. But
well, then how does 4 apply? Because 4 only applies to unwritten agreements. By definition, it only applies to unwritten agreements.
And this is the same argument that that Mr. Donovan raised in his first assignment of error in his brief. I would say that, A, it's not encompassed, or it wasn't raised below, so it's not preserved for appeal here today.
Let's assume you're right on that. Let's also assume the assignment of error actually doesn't cover it. What is your professional judgment as to how that gap in the statute should be reasoned through?
I would go to 8.01248, Your Honor, which is the catch-all statute for personal actions, which applies a two-year limitation period for any causes of action not so specified in any other statute. And that's why that argument, in the end, fails, because he doesn't even get the 3 years. He gets 2 years under the statute.
So the two-year statute would cover contractual breaches on written agreements against parties that have not signed it by parties who have.
According to Mr. Donovan, I don't believe that the General Assembly ever intended to write 246 in the manner to have a huge gap with respect to personal actions and contracts, the way that Mr. Donovan has suggested the questions that you posed here today. I think that would be a real injustice to the General Assembly, and indeed I think the precedents of this court and just about every other court in this Commonwealth have assumed that if a contract does not satisfy paragraph 2's requirements, that it automatically falls within paragraph 2.
I completely agree. It's an assumption. I wonder if the assumption is really, truly valid.
Your Honor, it's an interesting discourse. I just don't think it's really an issue for us here today, because I don't believe that there was a writing that embodied a full and complete agreement between the parties in this case, so we don't even need to get to it. Second of all, if you do counsel that, again, it would be a two-year limitation period that would apply in that instance. Your Honors, as I indicated, this Court has for over a century identified what is required for a written contract under paragraph 2. It must show on its face a full and complete agreement such that there is no room left for negotiation. Mr. Donovan's brief repeatedly concedes these points. And facts that were adduced or facts that were presented to the lower court, the circuit court, established that no such agreement existed. Those facts include that following the October 2005 motor vehicle accident, Mr. Donovan went to Mr. Bagwell's office. The two sat down and discussed the case and discussed, as Mr. Bagwell says, the fee. Mr. Bagwell indicated that Mr. Donovan did not formally retain him on that particular day, but that shortly thereafter he contacted him and retained him. Mr. Bagwell said that it was his habit and practice at the time to generally use or to memorialize contingency fee agreements in writing, but that he did not always do so. He said so candidly. He said every once in a while, where he knew the client very, very well, he would not memorialize it. And he testified that he and Mr. Donovan have known each other for over 60 years and were friends. He further testified that he does not remember there being a written retainer agreement in this case. And as some of the justices have pointed out, that he knows he never would have executed an agreement if there was one, because he never executed contingency fee agreements. Respectfully, Your Honors, these are more than enough facts for the lower court, for the circuit court, to have concluded that no such agreement existed. In essence, we had to prove a negative, and I think these facts were more than ample for us to meet our burden on that issue. Further, those facts also demonstrated unequivocally that he never executed the agreement. Simply, only the client would have signed the agreement. So those two factors were enough for the circuit court to conclude that neither requirement under paragraph 2 was met, and thus the three-year statute under paragraph 4 applied. In addition to the argument that Justice Kelsey and I just spoke about, there's another argument in the first assignment of error that I wish to raise. Mr. Donovan argues in his brief that he has a writing, which we disagree with, but he says he has a writing and he also has a signature because Mr. Bagwell, during the course of his representation of Mr. Donovan, signed certain pleadings with the court. Well, yes, he did. He did sign pleadings with the court. And what Mr. Donovan extrapolates that that satisfies the signature requirement, and in so doing, he cites to the United States Bankruptcy Court's decision in In re Lewis and says that that decision so holds that an attorney's signature to a pleading incorporates by reference or is applied to the written retainer agreement between the client and the attorney. Respectfully, I've read that decision a number of times, and it does not so hold. And so we would ask that the court disregard that argument. In addition, it was not raised below, so it's not preserved here for today. With respect to the claimants, to Mr. Donovan's second assignment of error, he contends that any writing will suffice under the Dixon case, the Dixon v. Hassell case, to satisfy Section 2 requirements. Respectfully, that is not an accurate statement of the law. Dixon is just repeats what I believe was the law for over the last century, is that you must have a complete and concluded agreement in writing in order for paragraph 2 to be satisfied, such that even minimal, seemingly non-material provisions, such as sign it and send it back to me, something that probably would never be sued for in a breach of contract case. The failure of the accepting party to do so does not create a written contract under paragraph 2. So, in this case, we don't have a writing. In this case, we don't have a signature. And as such, we believe that the circuit court was more than correct in applying paragraph 4's 3-year limitation period. And for these reasons, Your Honors, Mr. Bagwell respectfully requests that this court affirm Judge Cannon's ruling.
All right, thank you very much. The court will be in recess until 20 minutes to 11.
All right.